was the summer of 2016 when Wisconsin's nonpartisan Government Accountability Board was disbanded, and in its wake, the legislature and then Governor Scott Walker created the Bipartisan Wisconsin Ethics Commission and the Bipartisan Wisconsin Election Commission. It's your State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And while the administrator for our Elections Commission was recently featured on CBS's 60 Minutes, our first guest this morning is the administrator for the other half of government accountability, the Wisconsin Ethics Commission. And what would you like to ask them this morning? Phones are open for you at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Daniel Carlton is administrator for the Wisconsin Ethics Commission. Dan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Lee. Thanks for having me.
And you've got a big day today, as I understand it. There's a deadline today for candidates in the spring election to file their third campaign finance report of the year. What does that mean from your perspective and the work that you do, Dan?
So as you mentioned, today is a deadline for filing. The spring election usually is mostly local candidates, but local elections. For the commission, we regulate and we receive reports from candidates for judges, such as Court of Appeal judges, circuit court judges. We also receive financial disclosure, campaign finance disclosure for political action committees, independent expenditure committees, and political parties. They all file using our campaign finance information system. The local candidates, such as your village board members, your town board members, those types of officials, they file locally with their local clerk. So the reports are all public record. For the local candidates, you can obtain those from their clerk. Or for the judges, PACs, IECs, and political parties, you can view those reports on campaign financial information system as soon as they're filed.
So you've held this position on the Ethics Commission administrator since 2018. So give us a little bit of a bigger picture here, Dan, of what the commission does and how it operates.
The purpose of the commission is to promote and strengthen the faith and confidence of the people of Wisconsin and their government through the administration of campaign finance, lobbying, and ethics laws, and through readily available and understandable disclosure of information. There are three ways that we administer these laws: advice and education, auditing of filed reports, and complaints. To me, the most important thing that the commission does is provide advice and education that allows and ensures compliance with the law. As you may know, the commission is made up of six members. There are three Republicans and three Democrats. The four of the members are appointed by the legislative leaders. The other two are appointed from a slate that's presented to the governor and then confirmed by the Senate. And one of the things that I like to really mention when we're talking about the commission is how proud I am of the bipartisan nature of this commission. You know, since I came on board in September of 2018, there have been less than five tie votes at a commission meeting. And what was interesting to me is that each of those were immediately followed by the members reaching a consensus. Most of the votes were disagreement about whether to issue a warning or a small settlement. And it's important to note that no matter has been completed or has not been completed at the same meeting. The other thing that I like to talk about is our staff. We're a really small agency and we have a terrific team. We only have 8 people on board, plus an independent contractor who does our IT work. And despite our small size, we're able to provide a lot of resources to those who are our registrants, the campaign committees, the lobbyists and the principals, and the officials who are subject to the ethics laws. One of the things that I really like to point out is that we carry out some of the most extensive campaign finance auditing in the country. We conduct a full facial audit of every campaign finance report that's filed with the commission and audited for late reports across all program areas.
So let me stop you there, Dan. So the auditing is the thing that, I mean, advice and education is one of the three aspects you mentioned that you're most proud of, but this auditing is about as thorough as we'd find anywhere else?
Yes. It's interesting because a lot of the agencies that are similar to what we do will do kind of random auditing, and we actually audit every report that's filed with us. So, and we audit them for multiple things. We audit them to make sure they're filed on time. For campaign finance reports, we audit to make sure that all required information is present, and we audit to make sure that the balance of cash on hand is reported accurately.
Dan Carlton, our guest, administrator for the Wisconsin Ethics Commission, and taking your calls this morning at 1-800-642-1234. What do you want to know about lobbying in our state? How concerned are you about the actions of lobbyists or the power of campaign cash, especially considering the auditing that is being done with the Wisconsin Ethics Commission? 1-800-642-1234, where Jane and Suamico standing by. Jane, you're on the air this morning with Dan Carlton.
Yes, hello. This doesn't have to do with money, but it does have to do with ethics in Wisconsin government. I'm very concerned about Bob Spindell, who is one of the six members of the Wisconsin Election Commission. He is also one of the 10 fraudulent electors who were Republicans who submitted documents to the National Archives and other national organizations claiming to be the rightful electors, saying that Trump was elected president and not Biden. And he has not recused himself from votes that have to do with the elections. And I want to know why the Ethics Committee, and he said he was part of the vote that said there was nothing wrong with the fraudulent electors. I'd like to hear comments on that, please.
Jane, thank you. It was the 2015 Act that ended up splitting the Government Accountability Board into these two commissions, the Ethics Commission, who Dan Carlton is the administrator of and our guest this half hour, and the Elections Commission, of which Bob Spindell is one of the members. And do you have any oversight over the other commission, Dan? And give us some idea of the key differences between these two.
So the key differences between the two agencies are that the Wisconsin Elections Commission is responsible for administering the elections laws, such as voter registration, candidate eligibility, and things of that sort. We just regulate the campaign finance, lobbying, and ethics laws.
So does the other commission, the Elections Commission, fit under your purview of oversight at all?
So certainly the members of the Elections Commission would be state public officials for purposes of the ethics laws.
Okay. And so would you have any, but you, the oversight in that, in these members of the other commission would be in terms of campaign finance and lobbying, right?
So lobbying would definitely be a law that they would be subject to, as well as the code of ethics. It's interesting for people to note that, you know, the Ethics Commission's ethics laws don't cover everything that everybody might think is unethical.
Right.
You know, the statutes are drawn relatively narrowly to prevent officials from using their position in order to obtain financial gain for themselves, an organization that they're associated with, or their immediate family. So not everything that, you know, is covered under the ethics law is you know, what people tend to think of this as broader than really what we are.
Well, you're the administrator of the laws that are on the books, right? So the ethics laws that exist in Wisconsin statutes are what you have to operate from.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you, I mean, this is before 2018, you were serving on the Florida Senate Committee on Ethics and Elections and the Florida Commission on Ethics before coming to Wisconsin. So you've had some experience outside of our state. Dan, give us some idea of how ethics commissions differ from state to state.
One of the key differences from here in the Florida Ethics Commission, where I started off my career in ethics about 15 years ago, is that the Florida Ethics Commission doesn't regulate campaign finance. And they also have a significantly larger staff than we do. It's, you know, the ethics laws are very similar, although some of their provisions are a little bit more specific. But we do a much better job here in Wisconsin of regulating the lobbying laws and having the campaign finance laws implemented.
And there are some states, Wyoming, Idaho, don't have legislative ethics commissions. Do you see them as missing something? And if so, what component do you bring to state government, whether it be Florida, Wisconsin, or elsewhere?
I think that one of the biggest things that's a challenge for states is, maintaining these ethics commissions, creating them. Sometimes when they're talking about creating them, there's, you know, resistance to them. But they're a vital part of ensuring the public's confidence in government. And so I think it's important that, state-level ethics commissions are created.
Dan Carlton, our guest, administrator for the Wisconsin Ethics Commission. And if you had to write an ethical code for our state's public officials, What would you include? Worth asking this morning at 1-800-642-1234. You can add to the conversation via email, ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network. Any one of us has the ability to file a complaint with the Wisconsin Ethics Commission at any time and request an investigation into any alleged violation of campaign finance laws. It's your State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest is the nonpartisan administrator of our Ethics Commission. Have you ever made a complaint to the Wisconsin Ethics Commission? And what would you like to know about lobbying in our state? 1-800-642-1234 to join us. Our guest, Dan Carlton, administrator for the Wisconsin Ethics Commission. And Dan, as the Ethics Commission oversees complaints about campaign finance and lobbying in the state's code of ethics, and anyone can submit a complaint, what does that mean? Generally, what do the complaints you receive look like?
It depends on the time of year. Election time is obviously a very busy time. So far this year, we've received a bunch of complaints that focus on campaign finances requirement that people put paid for by, also known as an attribution statement, on their signs and on their mailers.
What happens in the event that they don't add a paid for by on their signs and mailers? And I've seen the flowchart on your website, and anybody can see it in WPR.org/mornings. We'll have a link to it. But if I were to put out as a candidate something that does not explain where that money came from, what's the cost?
So compliance is you know, one of those areas where that's the commission's first goal, is to make sure there's compliance. So we always try first to make sure that people go and add those paid for by statements on their signs, or you know, if they've already sent out the mailers, then there's probably not a way that they can go get those. But for their signs, we ask them to go and add the paid for by on there. In terms of potential penalties, you know, the campaign finance laws carry a penalty for each violation of up to $500. So, wow. You know, the penalties could be very severe. A lot of times, you know, you take into consideration facts like this is a first-time candidate, or maybe the printer made an error. And so, you know, the commission could really do anything from a warning to that $500 maximum.
So, and Jane from Suamico called before about Bob Spindell on the Wisconsin Elections Commission. When you receive a complaint, does that complaint become public at all? Or is that complaint because anybody can file it at any time about anybody that's under your purview? Give me a little more of the process and what becomes available to the public and what becomes an internal investigation, and how, you know, and as you mentioned, keeping the ethics of Wisconsin front and center so that we maintain the integrity of our government.
Sure. So the complaint process is, you know, we require the people to fill a notarized complaint form and, you know, provide details about the allegations. And once we receive it, we have to transmit it to the respondent within 5 days of receipt. They then have 15 days to respond before the commission can act. And the complaint and the response are presented to the commission at the next meeting. And the commission from there gets to decide whether there's reasonable suspicion of a violation, decide whether to order an investigation, or the commission could go ahead and proceed to settlement or some other disposition of the complaint.
And Dan, are those meetings public? Is that when the public could know that a complaint has been filed?
Complaints are confidential up until certain kind of endpoints. And so, no, we generally don't have complaint, you know, proceedings in public. They are usually done in closed session. But at the endpoints, there is information that is available to the public if they call and contact us. For example, settlement agreements are a public record, and somebody could request a copy of a settlement agreement.
Dan Carlton, our guest, administrator for the Wisconsin Ethics Commission, has been so since 2018. And Dan, the Ethics Commission monitors lobbying in Wisconsin, keeping stats on the most lobbied bills, the most active lobbyists, and more. Why is this important in terms of the mission of the Ethics Commission?
Really, the biggest significance is the transparency that it affords. It gives people a good window into what's going on in government. You know, who's out there and, you know, looking at and interested in certain legislation, who's, you know, spending a lot of time and effort to support or endorse legislation. And that's important for the public to know. The public has a right to know who's involved in influencing the government.
And you have, as mentioned before, the campaign finance reports available for everybody and publicly online. So how about the lobbying in Wisconsin, most lobbied bills, most active lobbyists, and that sort of data? Can we find that on your website as well?
You certainly can. You can find it on our website, lobbying.wi.gov. And it's a great time to note that website is actually getting ready to undergo a big upgrade. In a couple of weeks here, we're going to be releasing a new version of the website that is a little bit more user-friendly and intuitive for folks, and we're really excited to release that website.
Interesting. Looking forward to that. Dan Carlton, our guest, and the Ethics Commission also oversees the administration of Wisconsin's Code of Ethics for Public Officials. And what should, you know, as a non-public official, what's the most important thing you think I should know about these Code of Ethics, Dan?
The Code of Ethics is really designed to prevent, you know, kind of the things that the public worries about the most, some sort of self-dealing. And so, you know, broadly, the Ethics Code can just be described as, you know, a prohibition on officials using their position or office or resources within their trust in order to benefit themselves financially or their immediate family members or organizations they're associated with. And there are other things that are limited, such as acceptance of food and beverages and meals and such. Wisconsin has one of the strongest lobbying laws. And so, you know, it's those two laws work kind of hand in hand to assure that, you know, public officials are acting in the public interest.
Under state law, the Ethics Commission required to audit campaign reports to look for violations. Some campaign reports are due today, but the law doesn't spell out the procedure for resolving the possible violations, as I understand it. So what are the steps that the Ethics Commission takes when it finds a violation, Dan?
So when we first conduct the audit, we're doing a query of our database to identify potential violations. And, you know, at that first stage, they really are just potential violations. A lot of times we have to get further information to know whether something is a violation or is not a violation. For example, you know, we enforce the contribution limits, and there are times where committees will misreport and say it's from the wrong spouse. And it may look initially like an illegal contribution, an excess contribution, but we find out that it's actually from the spouse. So, you know, we have a process in place where for most campaign finance audits, we communicate with the committee and say, hey, it looks like there was a violation here. Can you explain to us what's going on? And then we have 30 days to fix that audit before we proceed to enforcement.
Dan Carlton, administrator for our Wisconsin Ethics Commission. And if you have a question, we've got room for you this morning at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas at WPR.org. What do you want to know about lobbying in our state campaign finance? What questions do you have about how we are moving forward as a state with our ethics? And Jim from Cedarburg actually wrote to ask if having legislators not meeting for over 6 months but still collecting their pay, he wants to know if that is something that is that a complaint that could be filed with the Ethics Commission? Does that fall under your purview?
No, that wouldn't be something that's within our purview. The legislature has the right to settle their salaries and how that's paid out. And so that's certainly something that they're allowed to do.
Dave from Winland wrote in to say the sheer fact that special interests fund our political campaigns indicates that there are no ethics in Wisconsin politics. But that seems to be exactly what you're working to refute, or at least working to, you know, to diminish, Dan. So how do you deal with the skeptics who say as long as there's money in the political process, there will be an undermining of ethics in our policy?
You know, from our perspective, the biggest thing is transparency. We want the people to be able to see, you know, where the money is coming from in politics. And that's readily available on our website. And folks can, you know, review our website, find out who's contributing to what candidates, and they can, you know, decide for themselves, you know, whether they think that's an appropriate thing for their officials to be, you know, accepting funds from, or, you know, causes that they're supporting.
And again, Dan Carlton doesn't get to decide for himself. You're administrating the statutes that you've been given under the Wisconsin Ethics Commission, correct?
Exactly.
So what penalty can a party face if they violate ethics, campaign finance, or lobbying laws, Dan?
So it varies across the program area, but generally speaking, in the campaign finance world, it's up to $500. Depending on the types of violations in ethics and lobbying, it could be up to $5,000.
Dan, I really appreciate your time this morning, and it's good to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Lee. I really appreciate the chance to be on.
You bet. Dan Carlton is the administrator for our Wisconsin's Ethics Commission. And we've got a link up this morning to the website. If you want to know more, check out the flow chart, the campaign finance reports, which are due in today for the spring candidates, and the updated website, which is weeks away for the lobbying. You can check that out on our website at WPR.org/mornings. Up next is news. Then the state capitol report continues with the latest on redistricting in Wisconsin. We'll learn what's ahead for district maps and voters before next month's election. I'm Lee Rayburn. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Lawyers for Wisconsin's Republican-controlled legislature, along with four voters, filed an emergency application to the U.S. Supreme Court, calling Governor Evers' proposal for redistricting state legislative maps a, quote, 21st-century racial gerrymander. This is your state capitol report on the Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And the legislature's case focused on the districts around Milwaukee that included a majority of black voters. Governor Evers' maps increased that number from 6 to 7. An unsigned majority opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court sided with the state legislature and returned the maps to our state Supreme Court. The legislature's proposed map would reduce Milwaukee's majority black legislative districts from 6 to 5. So what do you think about Wisconsin's redistricting process? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation or email ideas@WPR.org. Patrick Marley is a state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on, Lee.
So give us some idea of the reasoning that the majority opinion in the U.S. Supreme Court sent back our state legislative maps last week.
Well, federal law is pretty complicated when it comes to how you draw districts and the consideration of race. Essentially, you're not allowed to think about race when you're drawing maps. You have to draw them in a neutral way, unless you're in a part of a state where there is a large enough population of minority voters that they could coalesce and elect a candidate of their choosing. In that case, you have to draw maps to make sure that their voting rights are protected. And so the question here is, in Milwaukee, you know, what parts of the city do you need to be thinking about race? What parts of the city are you not allowed to think about it? And as you mentioned at the top, Governor Evers drew a map that would increase the number of assembly districts with black majorities from 6 to 7. The state Supreme Court selected that map, and the legislators went to the U.S. Supreme Court saying that they took into account the Voting Rights Act in too many cases and needed to go with the state legislators' maps. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court didn't go that far. They just said that there wasn't enough evidence to say that we need to take it to 7 majority black districts in Milwaukee and kicked it back to the state Supreme Court to figure out what to do next.
So the state Supreme Court could still select Governor Evers' map, but it would need at least an explanation?
That's exactly right. They would need to put together all the evidence saying why they thought there needed to be the 7th district. Now, that would be a risky proposal potentially, because the state legislators have made it clear that if the state Supreme Court does that, they will immediately run back to the U.S. Supreme Court. So, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court has left open this possibility, but they also haven't said that they will just sign off on whatever they do.
And while the majority opinion in this decision was unsigned, we do know Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan dissented, with Sotomayor writing the court's minority opinion, where she called the court's action unprecedented. How so?
Well, for one thing, it's very rare for the U.S. Supreme Court to act in these kinds of cases so late in the game. Our elections are coming up very soon. And you know, it was not so long ago that the U.S. Supreme Court declined to take redistricting cases because they were close to an election.
And how recent was that decision?
Well, one thing they did it in, I believe, Alabama recently, just a few weeks before this decision, where they didn't want to address these types of issues. It was kind of cutting in the opposite direction, but they said we're too close to the election to be acting right now. So that's why the dissent sees this as an area that the U.S. Supreme Court shouldn't be going at this time.
Patrick Marley, our guest. He is a state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Patrick, in a separate order, the Supreme Court declined to block congressional maps that the Wisconsin Supreme Court adopted last month. So our state legislative district maps back with the state Supreme Court, but it looks like we do have congressional maps going forward. What effect will these new congressional maps have on the races across the state?
So the biggest change with the congressional maps would be in the first district, which is in southeastern Wisconsin. Brian Stile represents that. That had been, or, you know, under the maps that were drawn a decade ago, a pretty strong Republican district, very solid. It would be an extremely rare circumstance for a Democrat to be able to win that seat. This moves it to a district that is about 2 points Republican in advantage. And so, you know, the Democrats have a fighting chance in that district, especially in a year where Democrats are well situated. Now, that does not appear to be this year. It looks like, you know, a pretty Republican year this time. But sometime over the next decade, if these maps were to hold, the Democrats would have a shot in that district. Now, when I say that if these maps were to hold, it looks like the congressional maps are locked in. It really doesn't seem to be a way for the Republicans to change those maps for this upcoming election. But, you know, do they have another legal fight later, or even draw a new set of maps in midstream? Those are two possibilities.
So that could still happen.
Well, if the Republicans win the governor's race this fall, and they will almost surely hold the legislature, they could say there's never been a map approved that was drawn by lawmakers. We should draw a new map. And so they could take another run at the congressional maps legislatively.
Well, what do you want to know about redistricting? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Patrick, you wrote on Thursday that the fight over redistricting in Wisconsin may come down to the decision of one justice on the state Supreme Court, and that would be Justice Brian Hagedorn. Tell us why he is so critical in this redistricting debate.
Brian Hagedorn was elected in 2019 with the support of Republicans, but he has at times sided with liberals on the court. Accepting Hagedorn, you've got three liberals and three conservatives on the court. And in an early stage in this redistricting fight, the majority of the court said that they were going to make as few changes to the existing maps as possible. That was a big win for Republicans because the existing maps were drawn in 2011. At a time when Republicans controlled all of state government and they have a big Republican advantage. So to say that the new maps will be modeled on those maps sort of builds in a large Republican majority. That decision was a 4-3 with Hagedorn in the majority along with the other conservatives. Fast forward a few months and it comes time to pick the specific maps that will be used. Hagedorn joins with the liberals to choose Governor Tony Evers' maps. And so you have, again, a 4-3 majority, but the majority is completely changed other than Brian Hagedorn. He's the one constant in these two majorities. Republican voters were very frustrated that Hagedorn had chosen Evers' maps. Obviously, the Republican lawmakers were frustrated with that because they went to the U.S. Supreme Court to reverse course here. So now, really, I think it does come down to what Hagedorn chooses. You know, where he views things, he can probably get three other justices to go along with him.
All right. So, Patrick, give us some idea of the timeline here, because as mentioned before, we are, I think, about 2 weeks from Friday from candidates being able to start circulating nomination papers for districts that may not be set 2 weeks by Friday. So what are we looking at next?
Yeah, the clock is very much ticking. You can't take out nomination papers if you don't know where the district lines are to get on the ballot. You have to go collect signatures from voters, and those voters have to live in your district. If you're a candidate, you can't go get those signatures if you don't know what the lines are, because you could, you know, walk up to someone and that person doesn't know if he or she lives in your district or not. So That means we either have to have maps in place by April 15th, which is when those nomination papers can come out, or we're going to need a court order that delays that date. Courts are going to be reluctant to, they're going to be reluctant to enact maps before they think they have all the information they need. They're also going to be reluctant to push back the voting process. You know, if you push back the date that people can gather signatures, does that mean you push back the date that they can turn them in? That's supposed to be June 1st. We have a primary on August 9th. It gets very tricky if you start talking about delaying elections, which no one has raised yet, but we're close enough in the process. You have to start to wonder if that's an option that courts start to consider.
An option where the courts start to consider delaying elections as we continue to debate our redistricting in Wisconsin. What questions do you have for our guest, Patrick Marley? 1-800-642-1234. We're George in Milwaukee standing by. George, you're on the air.
Hello. As I understand what the U.S. Supreme Court did, it said that the map going from six black districts in Milwaukee to seven took race into account illegally. But what I hadn't realized was that the maps that the Republicans want actually reduces the six to five seats. Couldn't that logic be used by the Wisconsin Supreme Court to support their choice of maps?
Patrick?
Absolutely. Yes, that's a very good point. I mean, if the first of all, the state Supreme Court has a number of options here, one of which would be to again approve Evers' maps and provide more evidence for why they think that it should go to a seventh seat in Milwaukee with the majority black population. Another would be to choose the Republican lawmakers' maps, which, as you say, takes it down to five. A third option would be to draw some new set of maps that keeps it at six, or take a plan from someone else, or come up with their own maps. The justices have a number of choices, though a limited amount of time. If the lawmakers were to again choose Evers' maps, the Republican lawmakers have been very, very clear that they will go back to the U.S. Supreme Court and try to knock those down. If the state justices go with the Republican maps that bring it to five, you'll have a reaction from the other side, where I think they'll run to probably not the U.S. Supreme Court, but a lower federal court to try to block those maps for the very reason you raise, which says that they haven't invoked the Voting Rights Act for this sixth district.
George, thank you for the call. Patrick Marley, our guest, state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's your state capitol report this morning, and if you have a question, our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. Our email is ideas@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn. It's the state capitol report on The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. So this month began with former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman urging the Assembly Committee on Campaigns and Elections to decertify the results of the 2020 presidential election in Wisconsin. This is your state capitol report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn. And on Thursday, Michael Gableman's own attorney told the same legislative committee that his client's idea was both impossible and pointless, saying, quote, "It's over." And yet here we are. So why do you think Michael Gableman's special counsel probe into the 2020 presidential election results is still ongoing? Take your questions this morning at 1-800-642-1234. Our guest is Patrick Marley, the state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Patrick, where are Republicans on this push for decertification, continued push for the decertification of the 2020 presidential election results in Wisconsin?
Well, the Assembly Speaker and most Republican lawmakers have said they don't believe the idea is possible, and so they have tried to tamp it down. But at the same time, Speaker Voss is the one who hired Michael Gableman, and Gableman is out there saying this is something that the lawmaker should be considering. So there's this intense tension and this push-pull. Timothy Rampton, a member of the State Assembly, is also running for governor, and his main issue is attempting to decertify the election, which, legal scholars, including many on the right, say is just simply impossible.
And at least on social media, it appears that somebody is vying to primary Robin Voss in a Republican race.
That's right. He does have a Republican opponent, and that opponent is someone who is main complaint against Voss is that he says he hasn't done enough to address the 2020 election and taken steps to change how future elections will be run.
Assembly Speaker Voss also said last week that he may rescind subpoenas issued to mayors and election officials as a result of the investigation. I've seen different takes on what this could possibly mean. What's your read on it, Patrick?
Well, there is a provision in state law that says if you are subpoenaed by the legislature, which, you know, there's been a lot of them recently, but this is really rare until this round of subpoenas that went out starting last fall, dozens of them. Before that, it had been probably the 1960s when there was last subpoenas issued by the legislature. It's possible some were issued in the 1970s. The record's not quite clear there. But at any rate, it had been decades since subpoenas had been issued. But the subpoenas, the state law says that when you receive a subpoena, that it confers upon you some immunity from prosecution. This is something lawmakers have known all along, and something that they said didn't concern them because they weren't trying to prosecute anyone. Obviously, lawmakers can't prosecute anyone. But as time has gone on, they have raised claims that criminal laws were violated. No prosecutor has come close to agreeing with that. And now Voss says he may want to pull back these subpoenas because he doesn't want to give people who he believes may have committed crimes any kind of protections from being charged with crimes. Now, Voss has been vague. He hasn't said what crimes he thinks people have violated, but he's saying this may be something that he does. And obviously, if they pull back the subpoenas, that effectively begins to end this wide-ranging review they've been doing since last summer.
So it could end the special counsel from the Assembly, Michael Gableman's investigation, but it could further criminal charges?
Well, it would mean that these people don't have any special protections, but you would need a DA or an attorney general to start doing their own investigation and charge someone. And, you know, we the only thing we've seen where anybody was raising the prospect of charges was out of some voting in nursing homes in Racine County, in which critics alleged that the State Elections Commission had violated election laws by allowing the nursing home voting to occur in the way that it did. Three district attorneys have looked at that and declined to issue charges. There's pending requests to two other district attorneys, but no signs right now that anyone's going to view that. Anyone with the ability to charge people is going to view that as a crime.
Let's go back to your calls now and then a question about what you think about Michael Gableman's investigation into the 2020 presidential election results in Wisconsin and the role that Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has played in this ongoing special counsel from the Assembly. You can join our conversation with our guest, Patrick Marley, from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. And in Campbellsport, you're on the air with Patrick Marley. Good morning.
Hi. Well, to stay on your topic, I think the Gableman investigation is a tremendous waste of taxpayer money. But my question goes back to the redistricting. And I think a majority of Wisconsinites, as evidenced by past referendums, want fair maps drawn by the state. But the state constitution requires the legislature to draw the maps. Going with Wisconsinites' wishes, I'm assuming we would need an amendment to the state constitution to have a bipartisan committee draw the maps. How would we go about doing that?
So is your question, Ann, how we get the maps out of the hands of the state legislature or how we can get fairer maps or both?
It's both. I would like to see it out of the hands of the legislatures. Otherwise, we're never going to have fair maps. And I'd like to see it follow the Ohio model where there is a bipartisan committee that draws the maps. But I think we have to change the Constitution to achieve that. I'm not sure if I'm right about that, but how would we go about doing that?
Yeah, Patrick, would we be dependent on the legislature to relinquish their own reins when it comes to redistricting every decade?
Then the short answer is yes. You would need the lawmakers to relinquish their power. They would have to be the ones to sign off on that. There's two ways you could do it. The lawmakers could just pass a law that hands it off to a commission of some type, that, like you describe, where the lawmakers say, although the Constitution gives us this power, we're turning that power over to a third party commission. States like Iowa have laws like that. Now, there would be a backstop on the end that would allow the legislators to have the final say, most likely. But there has been some success in some states in models like that, Iowa being probably the chief example. The other way, as you mentioned, would be to change the state constitution to create some kind of commission for drawing maps that would be part of the constitution. But to change the constitution in the state, you need the approval of the legislature. The legislature would have to propose the change, pass it by majorities in both houses, wait till a subsequent legislative session, do that again, and then they would send it to voters for voters to get the final say on whether we would change the Constitution.
Patrick Marley, you had an article last week that stuck with me, and I just want to make sure that I bring it up this morning, and it has to do with Wisconsinites with disabilities and their struggle with trying to find a way to cast a ballot in Wisconsin following a 4-3 decision by the Wisconsin Supreme Court regarding who can deliver absentee ballots. Tell us a little bit about this decision and how you found it affecting people with disabilities in Wisconsin.
Yeah, so this is a different issue. The last year, the group, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, with a couple of voters in suburban Milwaukee, sued over provisions of state law that they said weren't being followed. That was the use of ballot drop boxes, which has gotten a lot of attention. And then this idea of giving your ballot to someone else to return for you. You get an absentee ballot mailed to your home, and then you give it to a spouse or a friend or somebody who knocks on your door, and they turn the ballot into the clerk. A Waukesha County judge ruled in the favor of those who brought the lawsuit and said that only the voter can return his or her own ballot. They have to return it in person to the clerk, or they can put it in the mail. That case is now before the U.S. Supreme, I'm sorry, the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court has not issued a final ruling, but it did allow the judge's order to go into effect for this April election. So that's this interpretation that you can't have ballot drop boxes. You can't turn your ballot over to someone else to turn in. And in covering that, they discovered this issue with some disabled voters. Talked to a man from the Appleton area who doesn't have the use of his hands, and he can't put a ballot into the into a drop box. He can't put his ballot into a mailbox. He's caught in this place where he can get an absentee ballot, but he doesn't have a way under this judge's order to get it back to the clerk so that it could be counted.
Patrick, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Patrick Marley, state politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Just ahead, we're learning about the past and present and future of the Brown Berets here in Wisconsin. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. This has been your State Capitol Report on the Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.